From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Mary Casanova, an award-winning children's author of novels and picture books. We discussed her book, Frozen, an historical novel for young adults, published in 2013 by the University of Minnesota Press. Set during the roaring 1920s in the beautiful wild area on Rainy Lake where Minnesota meets Canada, Frozen tells the story of Sadie Rose, whose mother died under strange circumstances the same night that Sadie Rose was found, unable to speak, in a snowbank. When Mary Casanova and I spoke in 2013, I began by asking what she most enjoys about writing historical fiction. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I think writing historical fiction is about the closest we can ever come to time travel. And I love that every time I write a story set in another time, I learn so much about that time period and its people, and I feel like I get as close to living in that time as possible.
Yeah.
Stepping into the shoes of a character.
Yeah. You write books for children and young adults. Have you ever written any novels for older, for adults? Or?
No, I haven't. I always thought that that was the direction I would go until when I was 32 and I stumbled upon Hatchet by Gary Paulsen. Uh-huh. I'd never thought about writing for kids and thought, that's the kind of book that I would have loved to have read as an active, outdoorsy kind of girl. And decided to shift my emphasis to writing for younger readers and haven't changed that since. It's been over 20 years.
Wow, great. Yeah, and you've written quite a lot. I was looking at your website. Do you always know what your next project's going to be?
I start to know that I'm done with the one I'm working on when I start to get the inklings of a new idea that's coming forward just as I'm coming to the close of a project. So it seems like I always have a project in the works.
Yeah. Okay. And so you're never searching for the next idea. Usually by the time you're ready to write another book, you already know what it's going to be, basically.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And usually the challenge is too many ideas, not enough time.
Okay. Well, that's kind of a blessing, isn't it?
Yes. I think when I had my first book published, I was certain that that was all I had in me, with one good story. And then I wrote about a labor dispute that turned violent in 1989 in International Falls in a book called Riot. And for that book, I was sure I was writing about the scariest, most difficult thing I could write about, something I'd lived through. And now, 30 books later, I realized that we never really run out of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
If we stay curious and passionate about the world we live in, I think there's always something compelling to write about.
Do you tend to have to look for your ideas, or do they just sort of come to you unbidden and then start to develop in your mind?
Well, there's a great mystery about writing. I can talk about the writing process noon till night, but I think that it's still a real mystery. I believe the stories come to us,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to be my experience, that it's the stories that keep nudging at me. Whether I want to write them or not, I finally give in and write them.
Yeah.
So I do. Like, it is about listening more than anything.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Well, Frozen tells the story of Sadie Rose, a 16-year-old who hasn't spoken in 11 years since the day she was found in a snowbank, and she was actually found near her mother, who was dead during a storm. And her voice is gone, and her memories of her mother and what happened that night are also frozen, which is part of what the title comes from. So I'm wondering if this is based. I know I read a little bit. I read comments from people about how this was based in part on a true story. I'm wondering what that story is and how you came upon it.
Well, it's a pretty chilling and haunting account. 20 years ago, I came across this historic record of a little logging town in northern Minnesota in the same county that I live in, Kuchichin County. And in that town, a prostitute was found frozen one morning in the snow, and somebody took her frozen corpse and stood it up as a joke at the start of a town hall meeting inside the building. And all it said in the history book was, and allegedly caused quite a stir.
Mm.
Well, for me, it just would not let me go. For me, it caused me to think about it couldn't get the image out of my head and kept wondering, who was that woman? Why, you know, how could it be that another human being could treat her, even in her death, with such a lack of respect and dignity? And I just felt haunted by her story. However, how do you get at her story? Nobody was going to really keep a record of it beyond that. So as a writer, I had to keep thinking, what if? You know, well, finally I came to the idea, what if she had a daughter mm-hmm. who might have followed her out into that snowstorm and who maybe knows more about how her mother really died that night, but as you mentioned, doesn't remember what happened until later her memories start to come back to her.
Yeah.
So it is definitely based on a real incident. And then the challenge was, okay, I have this piece that's embedded in history that's the genesis for the story. But then what is the story out of that? And, you know, no story and no life happens in a vacuum. So the more I started to do research, the more I realized this is set during my character, Sadie Rose, is growing up during the Prohibition, during the suffrage movement. Women are just beginning to get they're on the verge of getting the right to vote. And there's so much happening at that time that's really very dramatic. So yeah. that's the setting I end up writing about.
Now, do you remember what exact year that happened with that town meeting that you talk about?
I want to say it was 1907 or 1909.
Okay.
I think in my story now, I have it as 1909, but it's close to the actual year. The area we live in, it's right on the Canadian border in Minnesota, and was one of the last to be settled frontiers. So this is the community I live in, Rainier, Minnesota, where I set the story, was teeming with brothels and mm-hmm. was a town of a lot of loggers coming through and a lot of, we've had aristocracy going out onto this big, vast lake that we live on called Rainy Lake. The class system was pretty stratified back then between the haves and the have-nots. So I use all of what's right around me as the setting for that story.
Okay. All right. Great. Now, you mentioned a minute ago your research, you had a lot to, unless you already knew all this stuff, you had a lot to research. There's information in here about the Ojibwa Native Americans mm-hmm. who are in this area, and then there are environmental issues, and then there's the medical information that you might have had to look into about a child who's been through a trauma. How do you approach research? What steps do you start with?
Well, I'm always starting with the character and then seeing what the character's sort of the needs are that present themselves. So as I was writing about this time and this era, I was looking for more information, of course, about prostitution in that time, who some of the women might have been, where they might have worked. Every bit of questioning would lead me to more questions. I use real historic places. There's a place in this story called Kettle Falls, which is truly in the middle of nowhere. You have to go about 40 miles by boat to get there mm-hmm. from one direction and 20 miles from another. And it was a hotbed of brothel activity and bootlegging in the 1920s. So I went there. I spent a night in that hotel that is on the historic register now and used that as part of my research, imagining life back then.
Mm-hmm.
So my research takes me in all kinds of directions. But this book, in many ways, and I've traveled to other countries to research other books that I've written, but this one was almost in my pores because I've lived in this northern area for 35 years, and many of the places I incorporate have been a part of my experience and fascination for a long time. There is an environmentalist I write about. I call him Victor Gutenberg.
Right.
The real environmentalist, his name was Ernest Oberholzer. He was a Harvard grad who ended up coming up to this area and started a little island that he called the University in the Wilderness. I've been going to that island called Mallard Island for 20 years with a group of writers every summer.
Oh, yeah.
On that island now, it's also on the historic register, are over 10,000 books, two usable player pianos, there's just, it's an incredible spot that blends civilization and wilderness.
Yeah.
That was his vision early on. And I then write about this environmentalist in the earlier stages of his life up here in this remote area.
Yeah.
So I'm drawing on a lot of what I have been living in a way and been fascinated by for years.
Now, just from a sort of
brass tacks standpoint, do you spend a lot of time on the internet doing your research, or are you out going to like historical societies and libraries and like that?
More of the latter. I definitely, when I have some detail that I can't quite pinpoint, I may start using the internet for more very specific questions. But I tend to be the kind of person who, I'm so setting-driven in my stories, I really need to know a place. So whether it's going to a museum and seeing the artifacts firsthand, seeing the clothing that might be, on a museum model, all of that's really important to me. Going to the actual places where a story is set.
So when I
wrote about Norway in World War II, I went to the exact islands where I was writing about the resistance movement and get as close to the exact proximity of where my characters would be. So that's a big part of my research. It's very first-hand research.
And what's the title of the book in Norway?
That one is called The Clipfish Code with a K.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, at a certain point in the novel, Sadie's memories start to return. And at that point, she recovers her ability to speak a little bit at a time. And I was really struck by the fact that her first word is no. And the context of it is she's thinking about her desire to study and learn and make something of herself. And she doesn't want to settle for peeling potatoes and hovering over cook pots for the rest of her life. And she vocalizes this with a single no. And I just found it really interesting that the first thing she expresses is self-protection. And I loved that. And I just wondered if you spent a lot of time figuring out what her first word was going to be.
Well, I appreciate your response to that, because even though I didn't really make a choice what was her word going to be, I think it came out of writing about her really becoming a full person. Mm-hmm. That saying no was a way. She is getting her voice back. I mean that, and this process of reclaiming it. But I think that sense of each of us having a voice is about really defining who we are and claiming it. And so for her, her life has been completely dictated by the demands and expectations of others. Mm-hmm. And for her to say no is the first step in claiming herself, I think. Mm-hmm. So yes, it was an important word when I wrote it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really struck me. As a writer, writing fiction, I find sometimes the easiest scenes to write are scenes with a lot of interaction between characters. And I was thinking about your work on this book, and I was thinking, Sadie Rose, she can't speak at the start of the book. She has no friends to speak of. She can't recall her past. And I wondered if it was a real challenge to write the early scenes of the story, given her isolation. Was that harder?
I think so. Yes, it is much easier to have a bunch of characters playing off of each other.
Yeah.
And, her world is so internal in the beginning that, you risk the risk was becoming somewhat saccharine or melodramatic, just being too self-absorbed in her world. And yet I felt like her world became so real to me, that her situation was compelling. She was truly voiceless, both literally and figuratively.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my compassion for her as a character helped me get through those scenes in the beginning where she is so isolated, so much in her own little compressed world.
Yeah.
One of the main themes in this book, of course, is about finding her voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a theme that seems to come up in almost everything I write. It doesn't matter what the time period is, what the age of the character is, but it's a constant theme. Mm-hmm. And I think as writers, we're always writing from something that is something that propels us, that's very, very deep. And it's different for every writer. But for me, I grew up in a family with 10 kids and 7 brothers.
Oh, wow.
And I needed to have a voice and didn't feel heard. And I think not only is every story an effort in finding that voice, but through every book I write, I find that I understand myself better and become more confident in who I am through the writing process.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, Mary, I'm thinking this might be a good point for you to read an excerpt from the book, if that would be okay.
Okay, I'll read from that very first page. Behind the silver-plated parlor stove in the corner, I sat up from my nest of blankets and shivered. Mama should have finished by then with customers who came for visiting. She should have come to wake me with a soft drumming of fingertips and carry me up to our bed. Except for someone snoring upstairs and the high-pitched wind howling outside, an unusual quiet had settled on the boarding house. Footsteps creaked on the staircase, step by slow step downward. I tucked back under my blankets and didn't make a sound. As long as I didn't get in the way, Darla let us stay. When Mama didn't work, I snuggled with her upstairs. She brushed my hair, read to me, and often said, "Things won't always be this way, Sadie Rose. Someday we'll have a home of our own." I pressed my cheek to the dusty floor and peered out between the curved legs of the cast-iron stove. A man stepped onto the parlor carpet of swirling reds and blues. Beneath his knee-length beaver coat appeared his dark pants and polished black boots, unlike so many worn and mud-covered boots that came and went. An edge of quilt, the same light blue circles on white as Mama's quilt, hung near the bottom of the man's coat. "Damn it," he huffed, fumbling with the handle. Before the door shut again, a gust of brittle cold whooshed in.
Thank you very much for reading that.
You're welcome.
That seeing that blanket is foreboding. It's
yes.
It's definitely not a good sign that she sees that blanket there.
No.
At what point in the process of writing the book did you write that opening?
I think that opening was something that I wrote very early on, actually.
It's often true
that my earliest pennings are very close to the initial, actually very close to the final draft. Now, they may be crafted word by word a little bit differently, but as a scene, I often start a book with the very scene that comes to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, because of the nature of Sadie Rose's lost memories and, you know, the gap in time from when her mother died and when she begins to kind of recover some of her memories, you had to be kind of creative about filling in the blanks for the reader little by little through the narrative. And I wondered if that was particularly difficult.
Well, I wish I had a story that would come to me whole and fully fleshed out. But my process in writing is very much, I think, like the reader's. I'm discovering page by page, scene by scene, a lot of my character's backstory. And that makes it an interesting process for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm learning more about my characters as I go. And, you know, oftentimes I wake up and that I kind of savor that time in the morning between half awake and fully awake. And I feel like that's the time when I'm writing a story that I really listen in, because that's often where I get the little pieces about my character, or characters, and the bits that I maybe didn't really know. Maybe at some deep, deep level I knew, but hadn't really tuned in and focused on the details, and then those ideas start coming to me at that point. So I cultivate that staying in bed an extra 10 minutes during that time.
Yeah. Okay, great. So your main character, Sadie Rose, she's impulsive and she's a little bit naughty. And I wondered, it is good. But it struck me, you know, when I was a teenage girl, I loved that kind of independence in the characters that I would read about. And I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about why does that appeal to teen readers and perhaps maybe even more girls, that sort of impulsivity and independence.
Yeah, I think even though we are in this modern age, I still think that as females, we still have so many shoulds, so many ways that we feel constrained, that we should be mm-hmm. nice, that we should be proper. And I grew up in a home that was the epitome of niceness in Minnesota. In fact, it's very hard for me even still to easily express anger. It takes me a while to figure out that I am angry. I'm so delayed in my reactions. So it's great fun for me to be able to let my characters at times have more freedom and maybe take more risks than I would take.
Yeah.
During that time in 1920, especially when many women were on the verge of letting go of corsets, but many of the older women still wore them, you know, Sadie Rose is so constrained by the expectations of her in society of really being seen but not heard. Her opinion isn't asked for. So when she takes some steps outside of those expectations and those boundaries, it's really delicious for me as a writer to let her cut loose a little bit, and be take some risk. Yes, be a bit impetuous and impulsive.
Yeah. Now, you were talking before about, you know, how a lot of writers have a recurrent theme that isn't necessarily even conscious, a theme that will come up in their work, and yours has tended to be finding your voice. You have, in the book, there's this line, words set things in motion. And the line has to do with Sadie recovering her speech. But I'm wondering about the written word. And in your case, has there ever been any fallout for you from having written a book because the words you wrote set things in motion?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's always that there's a part of writing that takes so much courage, I think, for anybody who writes. Well, I've mentioned probably the most dramatic is the book that I wrote called Riot, and it's several years ago now. Mm-hmm. But writing about something that had happened in a town where the labor dispute really blew up and became violent. So I was writing the draft because I needed to make sense of things happening around me, and as locals where I lived started to learn about that, I was getting threats saying, if you write this story, people aren't going to go to your husband's business. If you write this story, they're going to vote with their wallets.
Wow.
And I have to say, I mean, that was pretty chilling to be threatened in that sense. And certainly I was making no money as a writer at that time. We were living on my husband's income. And I had a shining moment with my husband, Charlie. At that point, I said, you know, I need to write about this to make sense of it. But it's another thing if our family's going to be hurt financially or worse, because there was a lot of violent acts going on. And he just looked at me and said, Mary, I know you're going to try to write this about things as fairly as you can. Go for freedom of speech. And boy, did I appreciate that in that moment. I was still pretty white-knuckled when that story came out, but it was 7 years after that event, and by then, things had calmed down a bit, and I think the story gave people a way to talk about what had happened. Similarly, this is another book, now I'm returning to my local area, where a lot of people have relatives that, you know, go way back and know this region well, know this vast 80-mile lake very well. So it was important to me that I write a story as true as I could as a writer and take some risks, but also be really true historically to the area. And I didn't know how the book would honestly be received. What's been great fun is to see that it's actually been just like wildly popular, and people seem to be loving it. And I'm so glad about that. And they're talking about this area's history.
Yeah.
So that's
now
you,
in referring to Riot, you were calling it a story. What form did that take? Was it a?
That was in the form of a novel written for about 9 or 10 year olds to 14. It would have been, you know, a middle grade to young adult novel.
Okay. Okay. Wow. It's incredible that people found it so threatening before they ever had a chance to see it.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. So yeah, you really never know what you're going to get for fallout, and sometimes it comes from unexpected corners. But that's the risk of claiming and choosing to use your voice, I guess.
Yeah, I liked that you put F. Scott Fitzgerald in the book. yeah, I liked that. And I wondered, it made me wonder if you read him, or read him again, I'm assuming you've read him before, in order to write about these times, or if he's a favorite author of yours.
Well, I certainly reread The Great Gatsby, just partly because I wanted to be back in the language of that time, and it was a way to just, you know, kind of immerse myself in that era. So when I'm doing research anyway, I'm trying to read it from a wide variety of sources from that time period. Mm-hmm. So it felt like a nice tip of the hat to include him in the book. And everybody on Summit Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota would have been well acquainted with him and known his work. So it fit perfectly in with my character and her family as well.
Yeah. And who else did you maybe read in order to familiarize yourself with these times?
Well, I'm trying to think right now. It's been, you know, a process of reading things over the years, but certainly I think of even A Movable Feast and Hemingway's work as capturing a time period and reading kind of a wide variety of things in that sense. I'm just looking at a little bit at my library shelf. Some of the books that I've, and just a sampling of some of the books in research. Oh, I went over, went to Canada to pick up a book, Mobsters and Run Rummers of Canada, Crossing the Line. My guess is some of the stories in that book by a fellow named Steinke, Gord Steinke, probably, maybe you have similar similar border history in Vermont. I'm not sure. A book that was very helpful in learning more of my area's history was a book called Keeper of the Wild by Joe Paddock, which chronicles the environmentalist I mentioned, Ernest Oberholzer, and his struggle, his David and Goliath struggle against this industrialist whose real name would have been E.W. Backus, and how one person could stand up to somebody of great, great wealth and power at that time in history and change the environmental course of things into the future so that now we have beautiful waterways instead of one big, enormous reservoir.
Yeah. Now, would it have been similar to, in your book, you know, the environmentalist is seen as a troublemaker and a rabble-rouser. He doesn't initially, anyway, have the support of the people in that area. Is that sort of the kind of opposition he had to go up against?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even though this industrialist wasn't necessarily loved, he was known as being quite a ruthless person, people still identified him as the source of jobs, countless jobs, at a paper mill, whether it's logging, developing. So nobody wanted to really go against him. And I think it took a long time for this area to even acknowledge the history the dramatic history that was left behind by this environmentalist. He wasn't given any credit for many, many years, and it's just starting to be recognized, honestly.
As I was reading the book, it was kind of fun going through, I wasn't actively thinking about it all the time, but there were so many different ways in which the title was relevant. Did you come up with the title, or did your publisher come up with the title?
You know, for several years, I had a completely different title. I was calling it Red Skirts Girl, because the prostitutes in that area often wore red skirts to the dance halls to be identified. And so it was easy for me to just hang on to that as the working title. But I think as time went by, I was able to let go of that and realize that that might perhaps limit the story to maybe just female readers. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure it had a broader audience. Fortunately, I'm finding that it's not just read by females. This tends to have a lot of men who are enjoying the story, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I would think that it appeals across, you know, the sexes and across the ages, because it is historical and it is, you know, very steeped in your geography. It's just beautifully written. The setting is just wonderful. And I'm not that familiar with that area, although I suspect that there are certain things about living in the winter world that are similar. And actually, I was going to ask you about that, Justin. You mentioned before how setting is so important to you. The publisher describes Frozen as being set, quote, during the roaring 1920s in the beautiful wild area on Rainy Lake, where Minnesota meets Canada. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing it's not super developed since, you know, in today. I don't know, but I'm wondering.
No, it's very, very much not developed. In fact, much of the lake that is here has been part of a national park called Voyageurs National Park for the last over 30 years, which means that much of it can't be developed and stays a wilderness lake. Mm. That and just the location, we're 3 hours from any larger city, 4.5 hours from Winnipeg, 3 hours from Duluth, Minnesota. So we're really not on the way to anywhere, and the people who come through this area are often fishermen and families on vacation.
Yeah, yeah. It's so do you find yourself going out and sitting in the place where you want to write about and taking lots and lots of notes and steeping yourself in that environment?
I definitely do. I spend time or just being active in that environment. You know, maybe it's canoeing around the island that I'm writing about and trying to take in, see things from another perspective. For instance, there's an island I use in the book. It's called, in real life, Atsikon Island. In the book, I call it Baird's Island. But it's an island that also has this history, and it's one of its owner, Jim Hansen, a friend of mine, was able to track down a big old wooden yacht that was once part of that family's island, and we brought it back from North Dakota. It was out in some farmland or something like that. Brought the boat back and restored it, and I've had a lot of time to be on that big old boat with him and going along the lake and learning the history that he's learned that's been passed down through his family. So a lot of that, all of, you know, every moment on that boat is learning and soaking in what I perceive to be the area's history.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. That shows, definitely.
Oh, good.
Now, the cover of the book is quite haunting, and one of the things that I did in preparing for our conversation was just went to your website, and also I went to Amazon and kind of looked at the list of your books, and a lot of your books are very colorful and very kind of bright. This book is very different, you know, the cover is muted and very haunting. So I wondered how the cover came to be. Did you have any input, and how did you feel about it? I think it's great, but I'm just curious.
Well, it's a funny thing. We, as writers, we get an idea in our head of what a cover is going to be. And I, at first, wasn't sure about the cover because I had submitted a photograph of a woman floating with her arms stretched out on Rainy Lake, and it was dated back to the start time of my story. And I thought, oh, and it was kind of this haunting picture. And they didn't go with it, and I was so expecting that when I saw the book cover. They told me later that it was actually just a little bit I don't know what the word was, like horrifying. It, little, it indicated a different story. So they came up with this cover, and at first it wasn't what I had in my mind, and now I have come to think of it as the perfect cover for the story. I think the marketing department, the folks who put it together and designed, really gave good thought to the tone that they wanted the story to convey. It's mysterious, mm-hmm. and it is haunting and very, very bleak, but in many ways that is the story as well.
Yeah, yeah. It sort of draws you in. It's very lovely, but also, you know, she doesn't look very happy. You know, she looks very contemplative. I think it's really effective.
Fantastic.
I'm curious what your revision process is like, Mary. How much of the book do you find is kind of intact when you get to a first draft? Do you revise as you go, or do you kind of have to then start over again?
Oh, let's see. I kind of do a circular process. I revise my opening chapters over and over and over. It seems like I need to get that foundation of the story. And then about the time I'm about a third of the way into the book, and I've done a lot of revising, getting my grounding, then I go through and push through and get the whole draft fairly quickly. And it's kind of funny because then those later chapters usually require much less revision, and I think it's because I finally have really hit my stride and found my story's voice.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't come so quickly in the beginning. I feel more like my process as a painter who starts out with, sketching. I have scenes in my head. They're there, but I can only sketch them in pencil. And as I keep coming back through those revisions, I start to add more layers of color and, you know, more oil paints, and eventually it starts to really reflect what I have in my head.
Yeah. How about structurally? Do you find that the structure that you set out, I guess we'll just talk about this book. I'm not sure that it would be the same in every book, but with Frozen, did you have to revamp your structure at all, or did you kind of know how you were going to set things up?
No, I actually, I started out with the structure. Here's the funny thing. Intuitively, I started out with the structure of flashback and then present life in for Sadie Rose, and then flashback. So it was going to be her memories were going to come back bit by bit.
Right.
And then I thought, you know, I'm going to do a workshop down in Key West, and workshop this novel because it was a little different than anything I'd worked on, and met under the tutelage of some pretty Pulitzer Prize winning kinds of authors, and mm-hmm. I was sort of instructed to, you need to get all of that flashback in right away. Just tell it chronologically. Get it all out there. And eventually I ended up going back to what I had originally had, which was a reminder that sometimes, yes, we need feedback, and other times we need to simply trust our instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And so so I think my original thinking on it was the way to go.
That's really good advice, that you have to kind of trust your instinct as well as other people. Do you get feedback from other people outside of workshops?
I have a writer's group that I'm part of, and I think more than anything that helps keep me going as a writer. just because it's writing, of course, can be so isolating. So having a group of local writers that I meet with a couple of times a month is really nice. Mm-hmm. But I'm also at a point where I have editors that are giving me feedback, and that's really, really helpful.
Now, are they giving you feedback as you go, or do they want to wait until you have a full first draft?
Well, they have to buy it first, so usually that's where having some other people be my readers along the way is helpful. Yeah. So I can get it to the point where the editors definitely want it and are interested and willing to put whatever extra work it requires into the story.
Okay. All right. Great. I don't want to give anything away, but I wanted to just have a kind of general overview conversation about endings and finding the right ending. There's mm-hmm. some mystery involved in this novel, because she's remembering things as she goes, there's mystery, and we don't know who had that blue quilt, you know. How would you define a satisfying ending in your opinion?
Ah, boy, it definitely comes down to ending where the basic conflict that the story has been exploring is resolved, but not going much further than that.
Okay.
Allowing the reader to ponder all of the other threads and how they may be resolved.
Uh-huh.
I guess a short way of saying that is not tying up every loose thread.
That's certainly how I prefer my endings.
Right, because the reader's imagination and taking the story into their mind beyond closing the book and reading the last page is really the power of story in my mind. I mean, I love to read a book or even see a movie that I'm carrying in my head and wondering about long after I've gotten to the end.
Yes.
So if I can do that in my stories, I think then, you know, I'm accomplishing something really valuable to readers.
Yeah.
I don't always maybe hit that mark, but I try for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Mary, what are you working on now?
Right now I'm knee deep in the Civil War. I'm writing something. This is probably for a little bit younger readers, though I tend to have a lot of adult readers on my work, even when I write younger things. But again, back to something historical. And I've spent a lot of time in Missouri and Tennessee the last few years. I do a lot of school visits and conference speaking, and I seem to be invited back there a lot. And I've been fascinated by the border wars, especially Missouri, a state torn apart between the North and the South. And
mm-hmm.
what if I look at that through the eyes of a character who maybe gets there via horseback time traveling? So that's what I'm working on. Something that I expect, I'm revising it, I'll be sending it out soon, and I'm calling it Moon Riders. So I expect it will find a home fairly quickly.
Moon Riders.
Yes.
Okay.
Something fun and historical and hopefully stretches a reader beyond where they are when they start the book.
And who's the audience for Moon Riders?
I think I'm really looking at, I have a boy as the main character, and trying to get those kids reading who are maybe sometimes reluctant readers,
mm-hmm.
struggling readers who will pick up a book because it looks like it promises some fun and adventure. So I would say this audience is going to be probably 9 to 13, somewhere in there.
Okay. All right. Great. What do you like to read, and do you have a few favorite authors?
Well, I love historical fiction. And so, like, you know, right now, of course, I've been reading a lot of Civil War because that's the time that I'm studying right now. So though I'm reading a lot of nonfiction, of course, I'm picking up classics like The Killer Angels by Michael Shara. A popular book that I thoroughly enjoyed was Water for Elephants, of course, by Sarah Brewer, I think. Lorna Landrick is an author. She's from Minnesota. I love her work. But I especially love her historical novel, Oh My Stars, set during the Depression. So I tend to just, I think that my favorites are always historical fiction, no matter what time period it might be. Even if it's covering something maybe that's, you know, set in Europe in the 16th century or 18th century. So that's my favorite always.
Yeah. Okay, great. Water for Elephants. I remember very specifically one of my sons and I had to go for a long trip, so we decided to listen to that in the car. And we both really, really enjoyed it. I think he was at an age where we could both kind of agree on this particular book. And we arrived, literally arrived at our destination right as the last word was read. It was so extraordinary. We were like, wow.
I'm curious, how old was your son at the time?
He was probably, I think, around 14.
So there's a great example of a crossover book, that an adult book that crosses down to younger or teen readers.
Yeah.
Or like the Frozen, I really didn't know if I should have written it for adults or young adults. And I finally just wrote it and thought, I'll let the editor decide. The editor thought it should be for adults. The marketing department said, let's make it for young adults. And I'm finding that I have as many adult readers as teen readers on this. And I love that.
You certainly have a lot of adult readers. I peeked in on Goodreads, and a lot of adult readers on Goodreads for this book. So
that's very satisfying. Very nice to know that. I like to always think that a good story will find its way to many readers, regardless of age.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Mary, I have one last question for you. I was looking over your blog a few days ago, and this line caught my eye. You wrote, I think this follow your heart or follow your gut approach to life is essential in the writing process. So I thought we could finish up the interview talking a little bit about what you mean by this and what writers can take away from this statement.
Well, earlier in the interview, I said that that writing takes a lot of courage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the hardest stories to write are those that we're terrified to write. Frozen was one of those ideas that when it came to me, I thought, This is a really tough topic, and I'm not sure that I'm up to it. I'm not sure I can do it. And after 10 years of talking about the concept, somebody in my writer's group finally said, Mary, just write the damn thing. And you know, it was my fear that was keeping me back. And I think because this one was so close to home, it was so much about one girl's journey in finding her voice and being pitted against others in power who did not want her to use her and find her voice. So I guess the bottom line is, yes, it's listen to your heart, listen to the stories that only you can write. And I really believe everybody out there has stories to write. It just takes courage to listen and to set the pen to paper or fingers on the keyboard. That's the discipline part of it. But just show up.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Okay, great. One little follow-up is the fact that this was so close to you for so long and you perhaps had a little bit of fear about writing it. Once you did show up, did it go pretty pretty well? Were you fearful every day, or once you had made that decision, did it flow pretty well?
No, I think I'm pretty much terrified every time I sit down and start a new project or a new chapter. What was difficult with this one is that I also have written a lot of books for American Girl. I've done this year's McKenna Stories. And that means that I've taken on projects with very intense deadlines, and that put me out on the road when the books do come out. And because I was writing Frozen without a contract, I didn't want to sign it up until I even knew what it was going to be. I had to keep picking it up and putting it down, so sometimes it would be a year before I could get back to it. And that was hard. To you know, try to shift gears and get back into that story. But it honestly wouldn't let me go, or I think I would have tried to drop the project.
Interesting. Wow. It certainly worked out well in the end. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Wow.
And it's published, I wanted to say, it's published by University of Minnesota Press. So, Mary, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed it.
Shayla, this has been a wonderful interview. Thank you. I very much enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Mary Casanova from 2013. You can learn more about her work on her website, marycasanova.com. Well, given the title of the book we just heard about, Frozen, and the very unpredictable spring weather that Vermont always gets, this week's Write the Book prompt is to write about the world being cold when it should be warm, or the world being warm when it should be cold. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at 993wbtv.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Facebook. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. Today, tell 7 friends. Just 7. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.